I'm an act. My name is Eric.
Hey, Eric. Everyone.
Thank you, Keith. Thank your sponsor, and thank the programming committee for having me out here. I'm an act. My name is Eric.
Hey, Eric.
I think I said that. I always get nervous because I don't think there's any way. I can't feel like I'm sharing honestly unless I expose my disease, the pain, the agony, the experience, strength, and hope that it took me to be here today. From, you know, like I was born and now I'm here. You know, there's a lot of stuff that happened in between that, but as it relates to recovery, I just like to get out of the way. So let's start again with a quick serenity prayer, if we could. Serenity prayer. God,
grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Thank you. So I blame my using and on my life situations, and that gave me an excuse to continue to do whatever I wanted to do from a really young age. I thought that, as a young boy, I wasn't getting what I wanted in my household, and it's really only recently through, I'm working on my 9th fourth step, that I've come to realize, like, my mother actually did try to do some stuff, but she was afflicted by this disease, but with self-centeredness, I thought I was 100% neglected. Even though we were neglected, but I could see her trying to have 5 kids by the time you're 21 years old, living in the projects in Brooklyn without any support, working 2 jobs, having the disease of addiction, manipulating your every step that you take. You know, it's probably pretty challenging. And the more I accepted that she has the disease, it was easier for me to start forgiving as well. Rather than think like, you know, my family and my upbringing was focused on me and how to make Eric miserable my whole life. But with that mindset, I did what I wanted when I wanted to. And with a bunch of 5 kids running around and my mother working 2 jobs and no dad around and no electricity and no hot water and, you know, no nice clothes and always judging myself from, what other people look like, you know, when, like, the first sneakers came out back in like the 70s and like Pro Keds. Like, we didn't have Pro Keds. We called them rejects. And I wore rejects. And that meant I was inferior. And I didn't like feeling inferior. I felt inferior enough without that stuff, let alone, you know, with being judged by the kids in school. And in the neighborhood I grew up, even later, like, we look for opportunities to rip each other down. You know, if a guy's shoelace was broken or he didn't have the right girlfriend or the right car or a thick enough gold chain or his stereo didn't kick out over 1,000 watts. I mean, it's just ridiculous to think about the things that we used to value each other on today. And so I felt like I didn't fit in anywhere. And when I first used, it gave me, I thought, a solution to what my problem was, because I didn't feel inferior anymore. When Debbie said to me, you ever smoked before? I was like, yeah. And I didn't even know what she was talking about, really. You know, and she's like, well, why don't you roll this? Again, I didn't know what she was talking about, but I know that night she kissed me because she was high, and I liked it. I was like, oh, wow, this relates to that. I don't feel alone. I feel accepted. There's even playing field. And, you know, I tried to recapture that feeling again and again, and it really quickly turned on me, like I'm sure it turned on all of us. So when I was 12 years old, and I felt like I wasn't getting what I wanted, I went out on my own. You know, I figured I know what to do from watching the kids in the neighborhood. And I went on for quite a number of years, really. And I was glad I was a juvenile because I used to get into so much trouble. And that was the way I got attention, was to get into trouble. If my mom came home when I was younger and she wasn't putting the focus on me and she had to help another kid with schoolwork or whatever, like, I knew how to get the attention. Eric took all the fish out of the fish tank and, you know, did something bad with them. You know, and like, you know, so like that was something that, you know, I got attention, or, you know, I punched a hole in the wall, I beat up my brothers or sisters, or, you know, just stuff that, you know, it was just, as negative as it was, I was trying to fill the empty space in my soul that I felt like I couldn't do it myself. I needed something outside of me to fill up this broken part of my spirit. And no matter how hard I tried all through my life until I came into Narcotics Anonymous, I was missing it. I tried so much stuff, and I think as an addict having the disease of addiction, you know, we get very creative. I know I did. I got very creative on trying to find the right thing to fix what's broken. But the problem was I didn't know what was broken. People told me I had a problem, but I didn't believe them. Like I thought, like I walked around undiagnosed in my life. It'd be like having some crazy disease where like you're walking down the street one day and all of a sudden your pinky turns blue and then it falls on the ground. Like, what the heck just happened? And then the next day, like, you know, your hair is red and then it all falls out, or, you know, you have all these strange things, you know, and you wake up and you're a big blueberry and like the Willy Wonka thing. You're like, what in the world is happening to me? I mean, I was that baffled. I was like, why do I keep ending up like this? I remember the first time as a juvenile, they put me into Rikers Island and they said, well, you know, like you've been doing these adult crimes. We can't keep you in Spofford anymore. So, like, I'm like, wait a minute, you made a mistake. No, I don't belong here. I'm thinking to myself, like, no, I don't belong here. This is wrong. Who can I talk to? Like, the judge already sentenced me. Like, I just got to talk to someone. I just got to explain my story to someone. I was always trying to get my way out of everything. And I was sitting alone in my cell, and when I got put into general population, you know, there was everybody I knew. I was like, oh, there's Gabe, that's what happened to him, and there's Joe. And like, I was worse than them, and they were grown-ups, you know, and I was like, wait a minute here, maybe I do belong in here. I think I actually do have a problem. You know, if these guys who I looked at them like, they were so bad, and I thought they were just left the neighborhood, you know? Like, oh, maybe we went down to the Jersey Shore and decided to live there, or we're traveling abroad, or I'm on a 6-month cruise around the world. No, you're in prison. And I hated being in there. For an addict like me to be confined, like literally I end up in the psych wards. But when I turned 18, I got my records expunged, which I was grateful, but that didn't last very long. I decided, after a series of really crazy stuff that I won't share because there's kids here, and I don't know how to say it without profanity, I read that sign. I might be, bleep, 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 bleep. But, you know, I wanted to do something. I always wanted to be okay. I always wanted to be all right. We were talking before the meeting. No one, like when they were kids, they said, oh, yeah, I can't wait to grow up and be an addict. Like, who wants to do that? You know, I didn't want to grow up and, like live on the street or go to jail or be hungry. You know, addiction is such a powerful, ravaging disease. It takes it stole my basic instinct to live, and it made things more important than even living. Like, as a human being, the will to survive is typically the most strongest will in a person. People have done amazing and astronomical feats just to stay alive in traumatic situations and horrifying events that happened in life, and they found the will. They found it, like someone rip a car off a door to pull a kid out, or move a mountain to accomplish something. And like, addiction trumps that. It trumps that. I remember being like, God, just please, like, take me out on the next one. I am so sick and tired of being sick and tired. I just can't stand this. And so like, the next time I got introduced was, I can never say I served in the military, because I never made it out of basic training. Okay? Because, and I did great. So, like, at the beginning, because I don't know how, there was no way they took the drug test that I took and used that score. There was absolutely no way. You know, I scored in the top 1% on my ASVAB test. So, like, yeah, you can do anything you want. And unbeknownst to me, I was like, yeah, I want to do communications and a counterintelligence, 35 Echo. And they're like, okay, yeah, whatever you want. So I get in there, and I feel good. I got my pockets full of, you know, the drug of the day. And I was nervous. And then, like, after 3 or 4 days, they called a big battalion meeting. And they said, oh, we get out to this big parade field. It was like 410 guys. And they said, all right, this is a moment of amnesty. Okay, if you have any, just like we said, weapons, drugs, or paraphernalia. If you have any drugs on you or paraphernalia or anything illegal, okay, here's your chance to get away with it. Okay? So we lined up alphabetically. Now, my last name, Z-U-R-L-O. Like, I was like in the back all the time. Like, oh, come on already, move this. And I was going to throw what I had on me in the bucket. So there was like, it was only about as big as like 2 porta-johns. And inside was a 55-gallon drum, a garbage pail that you throw your stuff out. You come out the other side of this little hut, and then you're scot-free. And I was like, oh, man, I really hate to get rid of this. And I'm like, you know, like, oh, yeah, terrible. I'm trying to get as much as I could. And so, like, after 409 people went in front of me, and I'm ready to, like, throw my stuff in there, I looked down there. I was like, whoa. And I stuffed my pockets. I walked out like, and, like, the drill sergeant was right on. I was like, Jello! I was like, yeah, drill sergeant! What do you got in your pocket? Nothing, drill sergeant! Drop it, give me 50. I was like, like, I was jingling all over the place. And, like, I used everything that I had with me in the next, like, 6, 7, 8 weeks, whatever it was. I don't know. I was out of my mind, but I did everything. They're like, but I did it to extreme. Like, they had this one thing where, like, they had this, like, dummy of a person, and we were doing bayonet training, and like, yeah, you have to attack it, and like, imagine this is your enemy, and all that stuff. And I reimagined it was my enemy. And I had a lot of enemies back on the corner in Brooklyn. And the way they were, I mean, they pulled me out of that. I was like, you know, like, all right, whoa, hey. So the first time, I was in my bunk, and I was trying to sleep, and I couldn't. I was going out of my mind. I never experienced withdrawal before then. I had run out of all the stuff I had. I did not care about anything when I wanted to get the next one. There was nothing that I would not do in my life, no matter how horrible, to go get something else. I learned that at a young age, that if you wanted something, you had to go get it yourself, because I felt like my family wasn't giving it to me and my friends weren't giving it to me, and I didn't want to go lacking, so I took that. And I ended up in a psychiatric ward in Fort Jackson, South Carolina. And I remember this doctor came up to me and goes, I think you have a drug problem. I was like, oh, another one. You know, like, what's the matter with these people? And then you call yourself a doctor? You know? So he says, look, he gave me a legal pad. He goes, write down the drugs that you do. He goes, I'll be back in a couple of minutes. So I'm writing. And he, like, he pokes his head in there. He goes, oh, okay, yeah. And he comes back again. And he goes, I was like, hey, what about the ones I don't really know the name of? You know, like, how do you want me to classify those? He goes, okay, that's enough. You know, I'm like on page 3, you know? And he said, he goes, I get it. He goes, you do have a drug problem. And they said, we'll give you an opportunity to go get some help go get some help and you retake basic. They had some type of program there. Or we have to let you go. So I was pig-headed and stubborn and self-willed, and I said, you know what, I don't need you guys. And it's probably glad, because, like, at the time I was thinking about how you get a tractor and trailer of the M16s back to Brooklyn. Like, that was my thought. You know, like, I could have been in Leavenworth, Kansas forever if I would have done that. And so that only fueled my negativity. And when I went back to the neighborhood, I felt like a loser on the inside, but I tried to feel like better on the outside. And I started doing grown-up crimes and bad stuff, and it brought me down. And for the next, like, 2.5, maybe 4 years, the next 4 years, I accumulated more stuff than I could ever have imagined. I had everything anyone could have ever asked for, all what I thought would have made me a success in the neighborhood. I was on top of the world. I had stacks of money and gold bullions. I was living in a penthouse in New York and I had an armed bodyguard with me, and I walk into Studio 54 and the guy would be like, yeah, come on, Eric. You know, I slip him 100. I mean, I thought I had everything that anyone ever wanted. And when I was overseas doing a business, and I got arrested over there. And that was horrible. That was the start of my decline, because I used to look at people that used the way I was eventually going to as being weak. I didn't know it wasn't, addiction is a disease and not a moral deficiency. I didn't know that till I came here. Like I said, I was undiagnosed. I didn't know what my problem was. My problem was they didn't understand me. My problem was they didn't give me a chance. My problem was they don't, was everybody else except for me. So, I spent 9 months in a prison in Rotterdam, Holland. And then the United States and my family, my sister actually, got me back to the U.S. But by the time I came back to the U.S., they took everything I had gotten and they just said, hey, this is a gift to the government. We can't try you again. We're not going to. And we fought for that. But now I had to turn myself in every single day into the federal building, every day. And they gave me a $40 per diem a day in New York City. Like, a couple of hot dogs in a subway ride? And I started doing and using, becoming just like the people I looked down at even worse. And I see how fast the progression of the disease was. So, and that was kind of like the start of my bottom. And if you could just think inside of yourself, you know, where that emptiness happens, where like there's no more you anymore. There's a Canadian folklore, it's called the Wendigo. And the Wendigo was like the werewolf story. He was bit by a wolf, a Wendigo. And like he was losing his humanity. He started changing more rapidly and more frequently, and he was losing his human kind. Like he didn't like what he was doing, but it kept happening more frequently. And I felt like at the end of the story, there's like one little blip of light, like at the end where like he was no longer a human, but he was this werewolf kind of guy. And like I felt like that. I felt like there was just, and it was so dim, the spark of light inside of me, that I felt like I was on the razor's edge. Like you can't stand there because it's too painful, it's too sharp. And like I was okay with either way at that point. Like either I go this way into darkness and despair until I'm dead, or like I try something different. And you know, if you're an addict, it's such a beautiful fellowship, and we're known today. Like we know NA is a, by society standards, is a viable solution for those with the disease of addiction today. You know, it used to be like, we're just going to send you to this therapy community for 2.5 years and we'll make you wear a dunce cap and a baby diaper and blah, 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 blah. And like they thought that that was it. But like we are such a powerful fellowship today. And I know, like I had a guy run by the office and he was sitting outside and he was doing one of these. You know, I was like, I walked up behind him, I was like, hey dude, you okay? And he's like, yeah man, I'm good. I was like, you don't look so good. I never seen him a day in my life. I was like, don't you go to meetings? He's like, oh man, I used to go. I was like, yeah, where was your home group? He's like, told me someplace somewhere that I didn't know. This was just in Pittsburgh. And I said to him, I was like, yeah man, they miss you over there. They pray for you every single time they have a home group. We pray for the addict suffering. I was like, you need to get your butt back over there. You know, and I don't know if I've never seen him again, but like, just to go up to a stranger who's high and be like, hey, why don't you get back to meetings? Like, it's probably a pretty good bet. You know, like, you've been here, you know, you try to do it your own way, and like, that didn't work, and you're stuck. You know, and like, this is a viable solution, and this is where I became properly diagnosed with the disease of addiction. I'm so grateful to have found this amazing, miraculous fellowship. Because, like, we speak the same language, the language of dopamine. Like, imagine, like, if I get it. Like, so I'm at my home group, and I'm like, you know, I'm having a hard day. You know, I don't know why I'm having a hard day. And this is where I figured out, like, if I don't know why I'm having a hard day or why I'm feeling like, eh, and I can't put it on something, I like, talk myself into, like, well, if you don't really know, maybe everything's really great. And if it's really great, why don't you act if it's really great? So why are you gloomy? And, like, I'm like, yeah, I was coming across the Liberty Bridge, and I just thought, like, what would it, you know, just let me cut the wheel to the left, you know? And, like, see, you guys laugh. You know, that's what I'm saying. We speak the same language. Like, you get it. You're like, whoa, you know, maybe you need to be. Like, yeah, but we get that. And it's just a fleeting thought. Yeah. But for, like, others to hear that, like, oh, my goodness. Like, yeah, I felt like using today. And, like, you try and talk to my neighbor, like, oh, yeah, I'm clean today. It's like, why wouldn't you be? You know? I'm clean, too. The key is to, like, I need to be around people that understand me. And my whole life, I was around people that didn't understand me. So, like, when I came into the fellowship and I started pulling a bunch of bull crap and, like, I know everything, like, I ripped out the stories out of the back of the basic text. I don't know, like, I got my own, you know, and I walk around with a basic text that was, like, this big instead of this big, you know. Like, people are like, what's up with your book? I'm like, eh. You know. This is the advanced version, you know. Like, just keep coming back, Gary. It's going to be all right. You know, and I did. I kept coming back because I felt something. You know, they talk about, like, this magic here where you can – there really is magic. Like, things that are – and miracles. A miracle, I define it as a change in the course of nature. Like, of what – of a cycle. Like, this happens, this happens, this happens, this happens, this happens, this happens. Oh, my gosh, you got clean. Like, the cycle is broken. And, like, addicts – for an addict to get clean when – using trumped my feeling, my will to survive. But without you guys, there is no me. Like, I couldn't imagine staying clean alone or by myself. You gave me everything. Like, everything. I have nothing without Narcotics Anonymous. Nothing. There would be no relationships, no assets, no hope, nothing. Nothing. I wouldn't know how to take action to help myself in my life. I wouldn't know how to... I didn't even know how to tie my shoes right till my sponsor's wife helped me out with that. You know, I would just always do it like you always did them. You leave your laces open, you know, back in the day, you know, and people actually still do that today. I just want to say, pick up your pants already, dude. Yeah. Only because, like I could identify with that, because when I came into recovery, I was just militant. I looked militant. I wore black all the time, and I wanted to be dark. You know, I had this dark soul, and it was my way of saying, please don't mess with me. I had piercings everywhere in my body, literally everywhere. And I just looked like a nut job. And people come up to me, it's like, dude, you have a smile? I was like, I smile all the time, man. You know, at the meetings, like, there's Grumpy Eric. I was like, what are they saying? You know, so I was sitting at home, you know, in my little place, and I'm like, and something was on TV. I'm like, I'm smiling. I held my face. I'm like, don't move. And I went into the bathroom, and I looked in the mirror, and I was like, I'm not smiling. Oh, my goodness. Like, I thought I was smiling. Like, what did I have to smile about out there? Like, oh, yeah, that joy. My man Pete laughed so well before the meeting about that can of soda thing. Like, I don't even know what you're talking about. My soul just clicked to you. Because, like, you just, it's laughter, it's levity of spirit. And that's what I wanted. I wanted to come out of the darkness of addiction and into the light of recovery. That's the attraction to me. You guys had hope and dreams. And so, like, I tried to change a bunch of stuff in my life. Like, I'm like, all right, I'm going to go buy a different shirt that's not black. And I remember I went and I found this black shirt that had these little pink or purple flowers on it. And I was like, I don't know if I could do this. And so I didn't get it. And I talked to my sponsor, and he's like, well, look at the guys in the meeting and see what they wear and what they do, and like trying to emulate them. Like, you don't have to be like them, but take what you need and leave the rest. So I was like, all right, and I must have picked the wrong guy, but because you tried to kiss me that night. But that's all right. I was honest with him, like, hey, you should have called me a few months ago, but no. There was nothing I would not do to get the next one. All right, so like, did I just admit that in public? Well, anyway, so what happened is, I got this black shirt with these purple flowers on it, and I couldn't believe it. I mean, I was drenched in sweat. I'm like, I'm going to the meeting. Everyone was like, "Hey man, nice shirt. Hey man, nice shirt." I was like, "Whew." You know, and like I learned that, and like learning how you tie your shoes, and learning, but more importantly, the life skills that I need to learn here. Like, don't use no matter what. 90 meetings in 90 days. You know, get a sponsor. And I got a sponsor at first, but it didn't work out because I picked a sponsor like I picked the kid guys in the neighborhood, the most craziest lunatics. You know? And my sponsor was a crazy lunatic, ex-gangster. He had 1 foot in and 1 foot out. And like, I didn't want to have 1 foot in and 1 foot out. Like, I was tired of that. I didn't want people, like, I got tired. I remember this one time I was using, and somebody was, I passed out on the subway train. And if you've ever been in like a big urban city, like transit is really packed. Like if you're going to work in New York City and like you got to get to work on time and it's rush hour, you stand in the train like this. Well, no, like this, but you stand in the train, you know, like you're jockeying for position. The door is like rubbing your back as the train door is closing, and that's how you get to work. But I woke up one day, I was passed out on the subway car, and it was like that, but there was a big wide space around me. And I opened my eyes and I saw regular human beings, like, going about their life. And I wished I could have melted into the plastic of the seat and just disappeared. You know, like, I didn't want to be there. I didn't like what I had become. I was embarrassed and humiliated and disgraced because that's not what I set out my life to be. I wanted something different. So I came in here and they said, if you want something you never had, you got to do something you never did. So I forced myself to do everything that I would do, like, that's a good idea. I walked the other way. And I tried, well, not everything. You know, I had to learn my own way. I had to learn that stuff wasn't working for me. I mean, I heard you and I saw the miracle, and then I would go up, when I did not follow the suggestions, I went up to the person that I got the suggestion from. I'm like, well, how did you get through that breakup? How did you get through that loss? How did you get through being broke? How did you go get a job with a long felony rap sheet? How did you do this? How did you do that? You know, how do you work on this step this way? And I got all the answers. And whatever I've learned in my life, whatever I seek out, I find. I've never not been able to find what I've sought. You know, we're tenacious. You know, I'm a tenacious person. I mean, I used when I had nothing. You know, I remember running around one block in New York, robbing seven people. It's like, you know, just like, all right, now we got to go. Like, whatever it took, there was nothing. And I had to put that same effort into my recovery. And like, everyone here, you're strong. You're like at the top of the food chain for like spiritual strength. Like, we don't make it here if we don't have that inside of us. And, you know, the power has to come from, my power comes from you and the God of my understanding. I have no power of my own. And I do have the control to not act out when I have power over my actions and my attitudes. And everything else I'm pretty much powerless over. But I only want power to control, but because I want it to be the way I want it to be. And if I don't, if I try and control it, it's never going to be that way. So if I surrender to it, then it ends up being not only how I wanted to be, but even better than I originally thought. Like, if I had God's magic wand and said, Eric, create your life and do this, I would have failed myself from where I am today. I would have failed it. My clean day is 6, 7, 8, 9, which is next week, actually. Yeah. And thank goodness, because if it was anything else, I would never remember it. 6, 7, 8, 9, I could, like, 6, 7, 8, 9. You know, unless it was 1, 2, 3, 4, which I wouldn't work. But, like, that works for me. 6, 7, 8, 9. And I've been clean since. I didn't have any vacations. But I did try this, you know, several times, and I got a little bit of clean time. But I realized, like, I was standing in my own way. I was my own worst enemy. I couldn't understand the concept of complacency. And complacency, for me, wasn't being egotistical. Complacency for me was, I define complacency as being indifferent in the face of imminent danger. Like, you're an addict, Eric. You have the disease of addiction. You cannot go see what Mike's doing in the biker bar on Friday night. Like that, like, it'd be like being in a foxhole and there's bullets whizzing by and you're at the front line and you just get up and like look around and see the, oh, hey, look at that. Like, you're gonna die. And like, I acted that way. So I had to turn complacency and like, I had to become vigilant and protective of my recovery. And the things that I love, I protect. I protect the people in my life. I protect my recovery. I put time and effort onto that. I remember my sponsor back in the day, he's like, how you doing? I was like, ah, man, I'm doing good. He goes, yeah. He goes, your rims look nice. I was like, damn right they do, man. I'm from Brooklyn. Your rims gotta look nice, man. And he laughed because he's a Southern boy. And he's like, how long did it take you to get them shiny that way? And I was like getting into it. So I was like, oh, well, this is what I do. And I polish them up with this and I buff them out with the rag and blah, blah, blah. He goes, well, that's more information I need to know. He goes, when was the last time you spent that amount of time on writing on your step?
Ooh.
Like, no, I haven't done that yet. I was like, all right. So I started working some steps and my life started changing dramatically. And I did about a step a year for the first 7 years, and it wasn't because like I didn't need those steps. It wasn't like, oh well, you're not on step 9, so you shouldn't make an amends if, you know, the opportunity is there, or you shouldn't pray or meditate. And but I had a lot of life situations, like cleaning up a lot of legal stuff and become like transforming myself from a street hoodlum into a respectable, responsible, productive member of society. So when I was driving, you know, in Georgia, and I got pulled over for the first time in recovery, the guy's like, is this funny? I was like, no, officer, I'm leaving. You know, because if I got pulled over any time prior to recovery, I was going to jail. I mean, I was going to jail. There was no time that I could not ever think that did not happen. So, like, I was like, yeah. He goes, all right. I told him, I was like, you know, and then like, you know, tell everybody, yeah, I'm clean. It's like, so I can search your car, you know, like, I was like, okay. And I had a Volkswagen Bug. It did about 30 miles an hour, top speed. It needed a lot of work, but it was like legitimate. You know, it was legitimate. It wasn't a Porsche or a Ferrari, but it was actually legitimate in my name. It wasn't stolen. I had one stolen regulator on it, right? Okay, but I stopped that when I had 9 months clean. And so here I am in recovery. This has been the most amazing journey. I have no idea how much time I have. It's 2:01. I don't know what time we started. But I want to tell you a story about, like, what it was like for me and what it's like today. And I tell this when I speak. I haven't spoken in probably a year now, but it's a story. It's called The Disappearing Ships, if anyone's heard that. And it goes like this. So when the first ships sailed across from European countries, and they sailed across to the Americas, they were looking for new land, and they were looking for something different. So they came across land finally after that whole, you know, the earth is flat kind of stuff. And they saw a beach and a little bit of land and the forest. And they saw a native tribe there. And so they pulled all the ships in and they set anchor. And during that time, the people on the boat, you know, they were looking at the tribe and they wondered why the tribe isn't responding to them. Because if I saw a full-rig clipper ship, okay, not just a boat, a full-rig clipper ship with like four masts and tens of thousands of feet of canvas, like just right there, I'd be like, whoa! Like, wow, look at that! But they just went on like, you know, nothing was different to them. So they were baffled by that. Why aren't they responding to this? So they were there for days. And one morning, the shaman, the spiritual leader of the tribe, was out for his early prayer meditation, and he stood by the water's edge and he saw some ripples. And he knew that cause and effect. If you see ripples, you throw a rock in there, you walk in there, there's a ripple effect. And so he started meditating on that. And the more he meditated on that, eventually the ships that were in front of him materialized. And So people have studied that story to try and find out, like, why couldn't these natives see the shift, something that was right in front of their face? And that's how I was with recovery. I could not see what was right in front of my face. I was clueless to it. Because the natives, when they saw those, first of all, boats didn't look like that. Their boats were canoes. They weren't big ships like that. They never saw a ship like that. They had no reference point to say that's a boat. You know, and then again, nothing they've ever seen in the history of the generations of the ancestors, nothing ever came across the water this way. Everything hugged the shoreline. So that's how I was with recovery. I didn't know, like, Pooka Booba and Nene on the corner, like they were getting clean. I didn't know anyone that got clean. I didn't know one single person that was successful in recovery. You died, or you ended up in prison, or you went missing. And no one came back to the corner and be like, yeah, hey, I'm doing great. Like, so for me, recovery wasn't even fathomable, just like for the natives. Those ships weren't there, so they were invisible to me. And like when I came into NA, you guys started acting as my shaman. You had the experience. So like the shaman did, he went back to the tribe and said, look what I see. And then it materialized for them too. It wasn't like some hocus pocus thing, but there was no idea or concept about that. And I wonder all the time, what ships are in front of me today that I'm not seeing? Like, what's in front of me today that I can't comprehend that I'll be able to get through it? The loss of a relationship, the death of someone that you love, a situation in business, a hope that you might be able to stay clean. These were all things that I didn't have a reference point. I didn't know anyone that was successful in that area of life until I came into NA and I hear stories, even if it's for a minute. I hear a story of success and hope and growth and change and trips to Italy, you know, and all this beautiful stuff. Like now I have a reference point. Now I have an idea of what it might look like. And like when I was in step six, my sponsor and I worked on creative visualization of the spirit. Like, what would your life be like if you had no fear to live your life fully? What would it be like if the big defect and shortcomings were not holding you back? Just like a shortcoming. Hey, I gotta get there to be where I wanna be. And like, I keep coming up short all the time. Why? Like, what's in my personality? What could I change in me? Not like, oh, life didn't give me the fair stuff like I thought about when I was a kid. It's available to us all. It's available, but it has to come from work. Without action, a door is just part of the wall, man. It's the one thing that holds me in. I have to use the door handle. I have to go through it. And sometimes I can't go through it alone. I need you guys. I need the hope and the freedom that comes with that. My life today, I can't even comprehend the miracles that's happened to me. I've gone to school. I came in with an eighth grade education. I got a GED, so I get in the Army. And you know, I've advanced my career. I'm on top of the food chain in my industry today. And not just one industry now, it's a couple of different industries, because I remember my sponsor telling me...
Oh, sorry. I don't like bees.
Don't blame me. So I remember my sponsor telling me, I was like, look, dude, I don't know what to do, I don't know what to do for work or whatever. He came up to me and goes, look, you survived out there, you'll survive in here. You know, not only you have an entire fellowship, and the fellowship got me jobs. The fellowship got me clothes. The fellowship helped me to eat. Like, I remember, I knew every family in recovery, I knew everyone's dinner plans. I knew the schedule of every family in recovery when I got in. I'd be like, yeah. I was like, oh, you guys eating dinner? No, it's okay. I'll come back some other time. No, sit down and eat something. Yeah, I was hungry, man. I was hungry. I came here. I had $37 and quarter in a sock, and it was one of my socks, and I didn't know how I got the money. And, I was busted. And I feel so free today, full of hope. And like hope, a promise of something greater in the future, you know, and like I still have that hope, and I've been working on that hope. So I'm gonna kinda, like, wrap it up, here in a minute, but, I remember one time I was traveling. Are we done?
No.
Oh, okay. No bees? All right. So, like, I remember I was traveling to see a client upstate New York, and it was in a place and a time where meetings aren't as popular as they are right now. And I'm like, I got to get to a meeting. And I finished up my client's side. It was like 7:45. I'm like, you know, there's nothing around here. You know, we didn't have the technology that we have today. Locate me. Locate a meeting. Hey, Siri, find me the nearest, you know. Like, so I was going to go back to my hotel, sleep for a few hours, and then drive back to Pittsburgh. So as I'm driving on the New York State on the thruway, I see, like, there's across on the thruway, there's, like, a hill, and there was a church there. I was like, huh. And there's a bunch of people outside. I was like, new meeting? Maybe not in the schedule. Could be, right? Not every secretary's on point, right? Oh, yeah, let me register with the world and say, here's our meeting. Or we cancel that meeting. You know, that happens to me all the time. I've been to meetings in 33 countries around the world. Some places, I don't even know what the hell they're saying. Itukatakamaka. I mean, I've been in a meeting with a Maori tribe in New Zealand. You know, I've been invited back to the country where I was not allowed to go to and help them translate the first Dutch basic text. Like, that's a miracle. Okay, I've done consulting work. Sorry for the spit. I've done consulting work in Army Intelligence Headquarters in Sierra Vista, Arizona. What I was going to do in the Army before I got, you know, unable to adapt to military lifestyle. Like, that was my discharge. That's my official discharge, right? And I was on a deal with the human lifestyle. Yeah. They say we reduce to the animal level. Well, my dog's tired. It goes to bed. Doesn't say, like, how can I stay up? You know, please. You know, like, it goes to bed. Like, it's worse than the animal level. Animals know what to do. They're hungry, they go eat. They go hum. They're like, fuck. They want to sleep, they sleep. I never did that. Yeah, guys, I don't want to party. I'm a little too tired, you know. But anyway, so back to the story. So here I am. I'm on the New York State Thruway. So I get off at the next exit, and I snake around the service entrance, and by the time I came around, it was like 8:05 or something, and nobody was in front, but all the cars were there. So I go inside the church, right? Everyone's in the basement. I'm like, I sit down, I see a coffee pot, I get up, I grab a cup of coffee, I'm sitting down there. After about 5 minutes, I realized it was a church gardening club. So I learned a lot of cool stuff about tulips and, like, how you should, and orchids, and how you should heat the knife and clean it before you, like, cut the things and all that. But the reason why that story is important to me was, like, I never felt compelled to go back to those horticulture people. Okay, I wouldn't have this drive in my soul that said, I'm so connected to you. Like, this is the hope I always look for. Like, but when I come to an NA meeting, like, I feel that. I feel that. I have a guy who's like, well, I don't know if I'm an addict. I'm like, dude, you've been here 2.5 years. Either you're worse than everybody here, because you don't know if you have a problem, okay? Or you want to hang out with us anyway. That's kind of, like, messed up, dude. That's kind of a little sicker than sick. So, yeah, I think I'll hang out in the psych ward for the next 10 years and then wonder, like, why I'm here. Like, no, you obviously like something about it. You connect to those people. You speak the same language. So I say that because I know I belong here. I feel this, the language of our souls connecting. You know, just today, I'm always looking for ways to improve my recovery. There's no advanced version of it. You know, it's just step work and constant step work and service work. You know, if self-centeredness is at the core of our disease, it's the core. Imagine it as like the root of a plant. Like, look, you can mow your weeds down your front lawn. They look nice for a little while until they're all weeds again. You know, or you can uproot it. And, like, the steps uproot it. The antithesis of self-centeredness is selfless service. So the more I give of myself freely, the more it screws up my disease, and I don't feel so trapped and so stuck. And I have a little bit of hope today. I know where I belong for the first time in my life. I know I belong here. I'm a proud member of Narcotics Anonymous. I have a super busy life today. I'm still a little obsessive compulsive. I got a 100-mile race I'm running in Ohio next Saturday. You know, like, I've been doing a lot of ultra running because I've been finding, like, I meditate when I run. And I cry. I didn't cry till I got into recovery. And in recovery. It's only been a couple of times, but when I'm out there and I'm at mile 72 of a run in the middle of the woods, and it's only me and God, and I have no more physical, there's no more ego. I got snot running down my nose. I think I pooped myself, you know, like my toenails came off, like I'm just still chugging along. You know, like to me, when I'm that raw, and I feel just the only thing is left is my connection to the God of my understanding, and the things that I've learned in here I carry with me, and it makes me, I feel such an interconnectedness, like I feel at the meetings, and outside the meeting it's really the only place I could find that level of connection. So yeah, I'm still working on that, but not today. So thank you for allowing me to be here. I love you guys, and enjoy the rest of the weekend.